This is the Advanced Allied Command Post.
American war correspondent Stanley Richardson has just returned from the Second Front beachhead with the first naval eyewitness of the operation. Mr. Richardson.
I've just returned from the channel approaches to the coast of France, where I was privileged to watch the opening phases of the largest scale military invasion operation in history. My ringside seat was the heaving deck of a United States Naval Patrol torpedo boat on which I traveled across the channel with the first contingent of a naval task force. This force was composed mostly of American units. From the time we left the British coast until we were within a short 2 or 3 miles of the French shore, our naval units encountered no enemy opposition whatsoever. That, perhaps, is the outstanding fact that I brought back with me. Altogether, my squadron of PT boats was in the channel for about 20 hours. We covered scores of square miles of rolling, choppy sea. We were patrolling and acting as escort for literally hundreds of slower-moving vessels of all descriptions. Many of them had been at sea longer than we had. But the Germans either were taken completely by surprise or just were afraid to come out and challenge us. Not a recognizable enemy plane appeared overhead. At least no bombs were dropped at or on any of the ships in our area. No low-flying fighters came over to strafe us with machine gun fire. And no enemy vessel, not even one of their vaunted E-boats, came out to the attack. The officers and men with whom I rode wondered searchingly about this. They had been keyed up for some real German opposition, both from the air and the sea. Their trigger fingers were itching for a scrap, and they were a very disappointed lot at not getting it. If the Germans weren't just too timid to come out, the only other ready explanation that could be advanced was that they were too busily engaged in coping with the Allied air attacks made on their shore establishment as a prelude to the actual landing of troops. In the area we covered, we could see hundreds of bombers and fighters shuttling back and forth, dropping their bomb loads and returning to England for more explosives to blast the enemy. And we could see the big two-engined American transport planes, also in the hundreds, returning to their bases in the United Kingdom after dropping their airborne troops in France. Yes, Jerry had a lot to keep him busy last night and early today. But as far as the naval phase of our activity was concerned, not a shot was exchanged with the enemy while I was on the scene. For that preliminary phase of the show, at any rate, it was all too incredibly easy. We left our patrol torpedo boat based in daylight to accompany the slow-moving light advance guard of ships, which had to pave the way for the actual landing. One of our missions was to protect the Allied minesweepers, which cleared a wide channel straight to the enemy shore for our troop transports and supply ships. Long lines of ships of every description were discernible on the skyline, literally miles of craft in even column converging upon the area in the channel marked for the concentration point for the actual invasion. Huge transports, tank landing ships, smaller troop landing craft, tankers and supply vessels of every kind plodded doggedly along under lowering skies and laboring over heavy seas. You people at home would have been thrilled to the bone to have seen all these American men, American ships, and American supplies sailing calmly into the action for which they had been prepared and trained for so many months. It was estimated that there were more than 4,000 ships of all kinds in the channel for this combined operation. By nightfall, we were nearing the French coast and our watch tightened. But nothing happened. Even when a full, near moon appearing fitfully from behind the clouds gave our position away clearly to any enemy who may have been lying in wait for us. Then the fast and heavy combat ships moved up into position. All aligned themselves in the bombardment area to loose a hail of high explosives to protect the troops moving into the beaches on their landing craft. The warships started laying their smoke screens preparatory to shooting their guns. It was within only a few minutes of H hour of the long-awaited D-Day. And right there was where I got the biggest disappointment of my life. We turned around and headed back at high speed for the English coast. Our PT squadron was under orders to return to base and refuel for another mission as soon as its first operation was completed. So I didn't even hear the bombardments begin. But I can tell you that if things are going as well now as they look to be going at the time I left the scene, it won't be long before our troops have a firm foothold. And now here is Merrill Muller at the advanced command post of the Allied forces.
This is Merrill Muller reporting from the advanced Allied command post of the invasion forces. Operations toward the liberation of Europe commenced just a few hours ago. Thousands of ships, both in the air and on the sea, and armies of men are in motion fighting the greatest military amphibious undertaking in history. The whole thing started moving when one man pressed a theoretical button some hours ago. That man was the Supreme Allied Commander, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who thinks of himself modestly as a Kansas farmer. Every evening, General Eisenhower gathered his staff around him in his secret headquarters, studied their faces, and asked their opinions. A gale had already roughened the channel, but the staff was confident on the winds, tide, and weather of today suiting an amphibious assault upon Europe. That was it. General Eisenhower wished his command his luck, and the great undertaking then and there began to unfold. The finest collection of military minds in the United Nations had created a plan they considered complete. Every possible contingency had been thought of. A tremendous mass of the greatest military equipment ever devised had been pooled by the Allied attacking forces. A bombardment, the likes of which the world has never seen, was ready to open. Everything that could humanly be done had been done up to the point when General Ike pushed the button. The campaign thus passed to the direction of God and the hands of the common soldier. Early Monday morning, as the huge invasion force made last-minute preparations, General Eisenhower checked his decision again with his staff. The word was still go. Good weather was the prediction for H hour D-Day. The dominating air support depends on good weather even more than the Allied navies. While landing craft of all types swung in and out of convoys to check their loadings and replace used fuel, General Eisenhower was busy doing the things he wanted to do, the only things he could do, visit his troops. As H-hour D-Day approaches, there is nothing more tactically useless than a supreme commander, except as an inspiration. General Ike is certainly that. I have never seen him more popular with his troops. I have never seen any commander receive greater acclaim or buoy his men more than does General Eisenhower. One British battalion cheered him as they clanked aboard their fast landing barge. He waved a friendly hello, and that broad grin lit up his face, a face that showed nothing but confidence in his men, a face in which fatigue is miraculously erased whenever it mirrors the Allied esprit de corps and the fighting spirit of the little men with rifle and bayonet. He came back from the port full of a sense of victory. No finer force ever went into battle with a better spirit or with greater courage than this one that General Eisenhower heads. In visiting with Royal and American Navy landing craft and with the Allied troops they will carry, the general had been given a lift. Some of his own nervous tension had been relieved. So he arrived at our hidden camp to meet the four correspondents attached to his staff. If I never attend another press conference in my life, I shall certainly remember this one. Perhaps because its outstanding factor was that it was more like a staff conference than a general talk to newspapermen. Here's the picture. Remember that all around us, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men were readying themselves for the outbreak of the battle that all the world had waited for four long, dark years. Men from the far corners of the world, ready to erase the stain of Dunkirk, to lift the shrouds of Nazi tyranny, to crush the Axis in the growth of the United Nations. Aeroplanes growled overhead. Ships were gathering and steaming off into the channel.
and final road convoys rumbled into the embarkation areas. We all sprawled around the general's private field office and were given the picture.
In a tiny tent, some 15 feet square, we sat and listened to the most amazing delivery of dynamic facts I have ever heard. We overcrowded and spilled half out of the tent onto its backyard concrete terrace.
It is a modest office.
The inner wall of the tent is half lined from the ground up with slats from packing cases. And some ingenious sergeant has stained those slats into imitation fine paneling. The floor is concrete with a couple of rope rugs. There's one desk, a telephone, two chairs, and a moderate wall mat. Otherwise, the tent show is a tree-shaded terrace and three pieces of deck chair furniture. You have to tear your eyes from the general to note these things, because he holds your interest completely. When you appreciate his tremendous command of facts and figures, duplicated, I think, only by General Marshall, you understand why he was picked for this assignment. It is not opportune to release the details of our briefing on behalf of the general, except in three general ways. One, he wanted all the credit for this campaign to go to the common soldiers of the Allied armies, and he emphasized the lower ranks and the word Allied. His order of the day takes that vein. Two, he had nothing but praise for the untiring efforts and inexhaustible research of his various staff and his various commanders for air, sea, armies, and supplies. Three, as to the actual plan itself, perhaps I can best put it this way. I have been in on all of General Eisenhower's amphibious assaults, but none was as involved or as mammoth as this one. Last-minute headaches? Yes. The general had a last-minute headache, and he expressed it beautifully when he suddenly jumped from his chair and said, "Good heavens, there's some sunshine." Otherwise, the invasion of Europe had already been pat for days. We came out of the tent and strolled toward his proudest, newest possession, just the general and myself. He praised his new mobile office, a super deluxe job built into a 10-ton truck and trailer and presented to him by the Lockheed workers here. And then I asked him about his own nerves. He stopped, hatless, from the sun. He is supposed to be phlegmatic. But he said quietly, "I'm so gall darn nervous, I boil over." He's not supposed to show it. He didn't either. I caught him only twice, wringing his hands or jiggling his English change. But I like reporting that he is human enough to feel what the lowliest of his troops feel. We went to a parachuter space just before their takeoff for France. For this invasion, the general honors his vast airborne forces that are now employed in battle. We went from airfield to airfield, talking to the airborne troops and to the Air Force crews that flew them to their targets. The general's car would roll up, and always the procedure was the same. The men would snap to attention, sneaking a final chew on their gum as they did so. Their faces were smeared with cocoa and linseed oil. It gave a Halloween twist to their grins. When the general ordered them to stand easy, he would move among them. "Where are you from?" General Ike would ask one boy. "What did you do in civilian life? How old are you? Are you a good shot with that rifle? What do you weigh? Who's the toughest man in the battalion?" And so it went down the line. And invariably, off in another corner of the field, the men would start shouting for Ike. Yes, just Ike. And over he'd go, repeating the questions all over again, verbally sparring with them, giving them the impression that this general was just one of the guys who thought they were the best soldiers in the world. One boy said he was an expert rifleman. "Good," said the general. "That's what we'll win for you tonight." From one quick-witted youngster, the general was told that the toughest man in the battalion would be selected after they jumped in France. "Good," said the general. "Send him back to me and I'll have something for him." But the visit was brief. The yell went down the line to load plane one, and the men started trooping off. General Ike yelled good luck and saluted them time after time. This outfit had been assigned the toughest mission of all. They knew it, and the general knew it. And both are part of a winning team. Soon, hundreds of planes were circling overhead in the gathering gloom, their warm yellow lights making them look like huge horizontal Christmas trees rushing into the night. They took formation and disappeared toward the channel, extinguishing their lights to make the first wave to strike on the second front. His face raised to their thundering black shapes, General Eisenhower watched the planes disappear toward France. Nothing to do now but sweat it out back at the camp. Try to read a cheap murder mystery or a Wild Westerner. Refrain from calling any of the commanders for news. Just hang on and wait. A stroll down the path with slippers and robe and another cigarette.
A pause to hear the faint passage of a fleet of bombers.
A game of checkers or gin rummy with Commander Butcher.
Will the night never end? Phlegmatic?
But when his men have left him behind, he's with them always, just the same. The battle has been joined until his men appeal to him for his renewed assistance. As the campaign takes more definite shape from its fluid beachhead, the general will take his chance and wait. Once he gets the call, the Supreme Commander-in-Chief, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, will step in beside his allied troops with their needs and as their inspiration.
We return you now to the United States.